A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Eureka, the show that gets under the skin of science in such a good way. Join us every week as we invite a new expert to help us answer one of science's most interesting questions, the questions that interest us the most. Not necessarily the same thing, but whatever. I'm Rick Edwards.
And I'm Dr. Michael Brooks.
Do you think it's misleading to always say Dr. Michael Brooks? Do you think it would be better to say I'm Michael Brooks?
I mean, to be honest,
I've got a PhD.
There's no other area of my life in which I would introduce myself
like that.
That's
what I mean.
So, but somehow it seems to have become the thing to do. And, you know, it's not... I mean, I could
Michael
drop
Brooks,
it. Should we just
PhD.
Drop it? No, I mean, that sounds worse, doesn't it? I mean, oh my God.
I think try a I'm Michael Brooks PhD.
Okay. And I'm Michael Brooks PhD.
Nice. That's terrible.
So, Rick, do you remember having that conversation about the birds and the bees?
Sort of dimly. I remember that it was my dad was the designated birds and bees explainer.
Oh, really?
And I was in the bath, I think. Which I don't...
That's already quite, sort of wrong,
no,
isn't it?
And I guess I would have been... I think I was pretty young. And I think my dad did an okay job of it. But, I mean, it's sort of... It's awful. Like, looking back, I was thinking, oh, my God, I feel so awkward. And but no doubt my dad was also absolutely hating it.
Yeah, yeah. And the two of you have never spoken about it since, presumably.
No, no. But my mum and dad just on... So we didn't have many books, but there was one bookshelf, small bookshelf, and one of the books on it was The Joy of Sex by Dr. Alex Comfort. And I would quite regularly flick through that.
Oh, you would? Okay.
Yeah.
At what sort of age?
Quite young, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I've never spoken to my mum and dad about this, but I wonder if they put that there because they knew that I'd sort of browse through the books and I might end up, you know, having a little look.
I mean, if they did, that's very, very poor from them. Really?
No, I think that's okay.
Do you?
Yeah. Like,
we had a copy of that at home as well, actually.
Right,
I remember.
I think there's a sort of certain generation of parents
who left it around.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just so kids could sort of, you know, soak up some of the good info.
My mum took me, I mean, she didn't even buy a book. She took me to the library and got a book on, you know, the birds and the bees,
right.
Human reproduction. I remember, I mean, this is so weird because I was no more than 8 years old. I know this because it was hiding in the library.
I was that sort of age,
I
reckon.
And, I don't know now. No, I'm starting to change my memory. And you know how that happens.
Yes,
anyway, so we went to the library and she asked, you know, do you have a book? She asked the librarian, do you have a book that, you know, would teach him about, you know, sex and stuff, and so she just like handed me this book and we never even had a conversation.
Just read that.
It was literally just
let
read that,
that. Be the ending.
Yeah, you've got 2 weeks and then it's due back.
I'll tell you what, I absolutely despise the cutesy phrase the birds and the bees.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't even know where it comes from really, but it makes me cringe so much.
Well,
it's horrible.
It is horrible, and let's not use it anymore today.
Yeah. Let's not do that.
But we're going to explore sexuality.
Okay. And what about it? Like, what determines it?
Yeah. Basically, what is it that forms our sexuality?
I feel like this is going to be an absolute minefield.
I think it's not going to be straightforward.
Good.
Yeah. Excellent.
We like to think of romance and attraction as passionate, spontaneous, and intangible. But what if that indescribable feeling in your chest is actually not so mysterious and is more to do with your brain? How do we even define something as intangible as sexuality? As of now, there are still 69 countries, stop sniggering at the back, in the world that criminalise homosexuality, and plenty more where it doesn't feel safe to be LGBTQ+.
We are saying no to homosexuality. Even animals don't do it. Why should we be forced to do it? Because we want to be seen to be smart, to be seen to be civilised and advanced.
Could scientific research help destigmatise people's sexualities?
Sexuality is contrary to God's created order. It is not natural for a man to lie with another man.
Love is love! Love is love! Love is love!
And of all the mammals on Earth, humans are in the 3-5% that are known to form lifelong bonds. So what determines who we form that bond with?
Will you marry me?
Yes! Oh my God!
And it's not just about who we're attracted to. Our animalistic sex drive can get us into trouble, whether it's sleeping with your best friend's ex, kissing a co-worker, or even just the thrill of the chase. Sit back, relax, and if you're with your family members, you might want to stop listening, as this week we're diving into the world of sex, and we're asking, what determines somebody's sexuality?
So, as ever, we've recruited an expert, obviously, to help us answer this. In this episode, we'll be speaking with Dr. Gerolf Rieger, who is part of the Social and Health Psychology Group at the University of Essex. And his work is focused on sexual orientation, everything from how it develops to how it affects someone's life.
So is there a kind of handy definition of sexuality that we can use?
No, I mean,
good.
I mean, it's it's interchangeable with orientation, much wider. It goes to sexual behavior, attractions, likes, dislikes, kinks, libido. It's basically an incredibly wide topic that we're going to talk about, really.
Yeah, so we're not just, because I think instinctively, I imagine that we're just going to be talking about orientation, but we're talking about lots more than that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because comes into it, clearly.
Orientation is a kind of a way of narrowing
sort of
down
focusing.
A conversation. Yeah, yeah. But actually the conversation needs to be much wider than that, because orientation isn't straightforward itself, is it?
So I certainly know some people who will fuck anything. they haven't narrowed the field down whatsoever.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm really looking forward to this because, as you know, us two vanilla, het, cis males, I mean, we've got this covered, haven't we?
The perfect people to discuss it. But we are, look, I think it's fair to say that we're not, like, experts. We have no real experience of diversity. Also, in fairness, you are, I suppose you're vanilla-ish, but you're not white, at least.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, we'll take that, shall we? Yeah, that's all we've got.
Well, we're just clinging on to the fact that you're not a white guy. but yeah, not the most diverse pairing. No. But we are interested.
Yeah, genuinely interested. And basically, you know, it's a really important conversation to be having, whoever you are and however you are, because the world is full of, you know, an incredible diversity of people, and we all have to interact with them. And as you know, you heard in the package, it's like 69 countries where you just literally can't be yourself if you're gay, if you're LGBTQ+. So, you know, let's at least talk about it, even if it doesn't directly affect us. But anyway, so I started off by asking Gerolf basically how you go about studying this.
When it comes to my own research methods on sexual orientation, I like to focus on behaviors and attitudes that are not simply depending on what people tell me, because it can be so much more revealing. And one stream of research that I've followed for years looks into the genital arousal of people to pornography, very explicit videos of men or women naked, and that shows us quite substantial sex differences that self-report would never reveal, which includes that women tend to get aroused to everything that's sexual in nature, no matter what they like. So that includes straight women who are straight. They get aroused to men, they get aroused to women, they get aroused to monkeys having sex. As soon as it's sexual, they get aroused.
Now, I know this stuff because on our first date, Ema said to me, right, I've been reading this book about female desire and you are going to go away and read it before we have a second date.
God,
so she
really?
set me homework, effectively.
God bless her, that's brilliant.
Book, I can't remember who it's by, but it's called something like What Women Want or What Women...
Oh, by Mel Gibson?
No, it's not the Mel Gibson one. It's got a very similar title. I don't think she would have wanted me to read anything by Mel Gibson. and it's got all of that stuff, and it's really interesting because, effectively, when you ask people, so when you get them to self-report what they're aroused by, people don't tell the truth.
No,
because
of course
there's
not.
All sort of, you know, stigma and kind of shame and stuff. But women, yeah, basically get turned on by anything sexual. So you show women some monkeys banging and they'll say, of course I'm not turned on by that. But you basically have probes in the vagina and they're like, well, you are getting turned on by that.
it's like, I don't imagine that like Dr. Geroff is there saying, no, you are.
Well, man, I don't know. He probably isn't, but he's noting it down. Going to himself, he's saying, "Well, you are actually." But it was a really fascinating book, and there was another thing.
So you read it? That's good.
Yeah, no, I read it, and I really enjoyed it, and it was very illuminating. And there was another thing where they showed pictures of a very, very attractive, sort of muscular man on a beach with a flaccid penis.
Yeah,
versus an unattractive sort of, you know, slightly out of shape, older, like bald guy with a boner, and the women were more turned on by the boner.
Right.
Which I thought was,
I mean,
sort of like encouraging in a way.
Feels like good news for me.
Yeah, it did feel like good news. but yeah, really like extraordinary. Yeah, quite, I was going to say counterintuitive, but counter to the way that it feels like we're sort of spoken to about sexuality and the way that the differences between men and women are that men are like constantly thinking about sex and like just horny devils always want it. And actually women, you know, it's not like that at all.
Yeah.
And this book basically says, well, that's bollocks.
Yeah. And there's so much cultural baggage, isn't there, that comes with it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is why Dr. Geroff does these sort of studies. And it's not just with probes and measuring sort of erections, but pupil dilation is the other thing that seems to be a really good measure of how you sort of, you know, how turned on you are, basically. So he's doing experiments where he shows, you know, men and women erotic stimuli. They sort of report their own sexuality and he sort of checks it out with these pupil dilation. And it's really interesting. So you get like self-identifying bisexual men.
Mm-hmm.
They showed substantial sort of pupil dilation to both sexes, right? Which is exactly what you'd expect.
Mm-hmm.
But among women, it was the heterosexual women that showed the most substantial dilation to both sexes, right? So like you say, it's basically... they are turned on by everything.
Yeah.
Effectively. And the studies sort of, it's interesting because most of the studies that are done historically seem to show that like men have higher sex drives than women, right? But, you know, what you're finding is that actually, you know, for a start, when you look at couples and you ask them to report on their sort of relative sex drives, it's really 50-50 whether it's the man or the woman that has the lower sex drive. So you know, that kind of tells you that, okay, so it's not this kind of massively skewed graph for a start. Although that will be skewed as well by the fact that when men get into a stable relationship, their testosterone drops, basically, so that they don't, not so that, but the result is that they don't quite stray as much. I guess their sex drive is reduced.
Right.
Their kind of willingness to sort of populate outside the relationship.
Is that an evolutionary diminished.
You would think so, wouldn't you?
Thing,
yeah,
possibly.
I mean, you would think so. I mean, it certainly makes sense. You know, if you want to preserve that pair bond, basically, you know, you get into this chemical environment in your relationship, effectively, that just turns down your sex drive and your willingness to go and look for another partner.
I sort of slightly buy that, but then I think to myself, from an evolutionary point of view, do you not want to be trying to procreate with as many partners as possible? Is that not a sort
I don't
of,
think that's necessary, is it? If you think not, of it in no, evolutionary not, terms, once you've got a sort of stable relationship and a pair bond and your children, you know, your genetic offspring are going to be sort of looked after and grown to adulthood, that selfish gene thing is sort of is satisfied, surely.
But if you can have more and more genetic offspring, that covers all your bases, doesn't it?
I mean, it does. It's sort
of
not culturally, it's not how we tend to operate, is it?
No, culturally, no.
So, I mean, it certainly does happen, doesn't it? But I think, you know, it's a complex mix of you know, genetics, biochemistry, and then cultural factors in terms of, you know, what's acceptable and what's not. So,
I suppose that the thinking about the sort of cost of cheating.
Yeah,
that's quite interesting. So within the cultural framework,
for us it's quite high,
And it's going to be different across all sorts of measures. Actually, I guess, but
it's interesting because in our culture, certainly, I think the cost of cheating is higher for women than for men, or certainly historically it has been.
Yeah,
maybe that's not true. Or not so true anymore, but it certainly has been true sort of the past few hundred years.
This might be a sort of personal prejudice, but I feel like posh people are worse. and sort of more judgmental and hypocritical. But I did bear in mind, I hosted the Made in Chelsea end of season party for many, many years.
Yeah,
so I've got
a very
specific relationship with the posh.
Yeah, although you say that, and I was thinking of the Marquess of Bath, you know, that... That guy who's like, he's got like, I don't know, he's got like three or four wives, or he's quite often on the news. You know, he comes out and says something, and then they'll show him, like, you know, and they'll mention how he lives in this sort of, you know, non-monogamous relationship as if it's the most shocking thing that's ever basically come across the news desk.
But he's doing it in
long league guy.
Like openly, and everyone's happy with it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's happy with it. Yeah. Who's to know?
Of course. Yeah. Yeah.
And then there's the interesting factor where, you know, you're watching an Attenborough documentary or something, and it's like, oh, these penguins, they you know, pair bond for life. And everyone goes, oh, isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, you're like, oh, that's cute.
And that's just such horseshit, isn't it? It's like, why is that a better system than, like, the bonobos, who basically shag all the time as a kind of hello, basically. and you know, male,
we don't really talk
female,
about
female.
That.
No, you don't see Attenborough saying,
bonobos.
Oh, that's good, isn't it?
Bonobos are always like, these guys are just so sort of peaceful and harmonious.
And they all get on so well together.
Because they're fucking.
Yeah, basically. You know, we don't know it's because they're fucking, but it's certainly part of their social system. So maybe the penguins are missing a trick, is my point, really. But, you know, so really my point is that we have certain cultural values that really shine through when we look at other animals.
And you
impose these ideas of what's ideal
and kind
and what
of
isn't.
Right, rules, effectively.
Yeah. And so, you know, when we end up sort of finding out that someone's cheated or whatever, you know, there's a kind of, you know, collective intake of breath, and it's like, you know, and we just have set up rules in our society that mean that's not an acceptable thing to do. But it's not really, like, you know, it's made up. Effectively,
it's not innate.
No, and one of the interesting things is that people will say, "Oh, you know, I can't help myself." And you read these things about, you know, it's like there was just such chemistry between us, I couldn't do anything about it. And it's sort of an interesting phenomenon that sometimes people will just say they can't help themselves, and no matter what the cultural value, no matter what the social mores are, they just do it anyway. And I think that's a kind of interesting insight into maybe, you know, the layer beneath the one that we like to keep on the surface. It's something I asked Dr. Rieger about.
Sex drive notoriously overrides our rational decisions, and it is part of the biological package in humans, at least, if not in other species, the sex drive. So the wish to have sex with somebody in combination with our sexual orientation, are we attracted to the opposite sex? Those are strong basic ingredients that we even mate and reproduce. Otherwise, why would we do it? If you think about it, getting close physically to a stranger, sticking genitals into others' people's genitals, it's, if you take the sex drive out, it actually ends up being a fairly gross experience. So it is something that we need to override. And that means that this drive has evolved to become very, very strong. Now, if there is the opportunity to have sex, we want to go for it. We want to take the risk. We want to take the risk of being caught. We want to take the risk of catching a sexually transmitted disease and so forth. Sex drive, I think, has evolved to override our logic. And this is why we always get into trouble as a species.
So, yeah, I get what Dr. Rieger is saying about if you divorce the sort of the pleasure aspect entirely from sex and just look at it in a very practical, dispassionate way, it's gross.
Is it though? I mean,
But if you're not getting any pleasure from it, like, why would you want to put a bit of your body into someone else's body? Or have a bit of someone else's body in your body. Like, you're just like, well, no, I don't want to. It might be dirty. Like,
yeah,
just,
no.
So it needs to be some sort of reward. And a reward is, it's fantastic.
The reward is that it feels good. So I'm not sure you can divorce the sex drive from the act itself. Unless you're boning a piece of pork or something.
Which, to be clear, I'm not. I suppose, though, that there's lots of examples in the rest of the animal kingdom where there is no pleasure involved for either partner.
Do we know that?
I think we do. I mean, first of
all right, which parts of the animal kingdom are you thinking of?
Well, I'm thinking most of it. I'm thinking we're quite unusual in deriving pleasure from sex. I think the great apes, just look at how many of them actually have sex recreationally. You don't see it in the animal kingdom, really.
Hmm.
And that's going to be because it's just a purely practical exchange of material.
I'm not sure that's true.
You're not sure that's true?
I think that is true.
So we're at an impasse here.
I don't think
most animals enjoy sex.
Well,
Do you think they do?
I don't see why they wouldn't.
Well, no, if you've got a bit, you could just look and say...
Nerve sensitivity that produces a pleasure response in the brain. So
I'm saying I think lots of animals don't. That's what I'm saying. I don't think they are necessarily erogenous zones. I think we have very well-developed erogenous zones. I'm not sure other animals do.
I don't know. I think
I'm at the point where I'm about to Google, do animals have erogenous zones?
Because when you stroke a dog or a cat, for instance, that is pleasurable to the dog and cat, right? Raffi, our dog,
mm-hmm.
when she really enjoys getting stroked, and she most enjoys getting stroked on her, basically on her rump, just, you know, the back frame.
Yeah, yeah.
And it strikes me that, you know, she, and you watch her, and when she's really into it, she's really into it, right?
Right, okay.
It makes me slightly, you know, unsettled, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you think, well, you know, if she's mating, if she's being mounted by another dog, that's exactly the part of her that would get rubbed up against and get rubbed. And you know, it's not like the human orgasm is surely, like, humans aren't the only animal to orgasm, and human females aren't the only females to orgasm. And so we know that the orgasm helps with fertility, for instance,
and
so wouldn't it make sense?
Doesn't it sort of suck the sperm up as well, pull the sperm towards
the egg, into the uterus? So it makes sense that evolution wouldn't have just done that with us; it would have done it with every animal, which means they must have erogenous zones
mammals,
and enjoy themselves.
Mammals, yes, potentially, because mammals all have the same sort of, as you'd imagine, the same sort of structures.
Yeah.
We might need to.
We'll carry on while you Google. Google your half thought through research.
Yeah, I mean, this is real MP in Parliament stuff. And then what were you looking at? Well.
Tractors.
Yeah. I'm just trying to find.
Do tractors have erogenous zones?
Well, that's pretty interesting. Oral sex is well known among short nosed fruit bats.
Yes, it is. I know that. And actually, what that does is extend the male's ability to basically stave off ejaculation so the female gets more pleasure. So there.
Okay. So hang on. All right. I guess I'm going outside of mammals. I'm very interested to know if anything is a. Well, no.
I like the way you backed away so you've gone like right outside of mammals now. It's like you were so convinced before, but now, okay. All right, mammals. You're going to give me mammals.
Okay, I might give you. I'm still not convinced, actually, but I might give you mammals.
I mean, fish don't count because obviously they just like put the eggs down and then it gets fertilized outside the body. So that
fish don't have sex.
They're not having sex. Yeah.
Okay, so we need something that has sex that doesn't enjoy it.
And we'll be back after we've Googled the hell out of this and ruined our search history.
Right. I mean, this is not what we were supposed to be talking about.
I mean, look, like the MP watching porn, right? You know, it's just unconscionable and there's no excuse for it whatsoever because, you know, it's not like we don't have free will over our sex drive, but there is a drive.
Yeah.
Nonetheless.
Yeah.
And it's kind of interesting. You get that celebrity, you know, I was a sex addict kind of thing. So like Charlie Sheen said it, Michael Douglas said it. I mean, Michael Douglas said he basically got throat cancer because he'd given so many women oral sex.
Yeah.
Because he was addicted to the whole thing.
Yeah.
Callum Best as
like
well.
Like a short-nosed fruit.
and it's sort of... The pursuit of sex is certainly a sort of end for a lot of people, and they will risk a lot for it. So, you know, you either risk you losing your seat in parliament or you're risking losing your relationship because you just can't stop yourself doing it. But I think that's much more psychological than it is, you know, a physiological, biological drive. I think that's probably more to do with who you are and... you know, and kind of, you know, what you've experienced in the past and where you've been and stuff like that. So, but there are, you know, I mean, there are sort of studies that show that men are more likely to break up with their long-term partner if basically they don't feel that they are sexually accessible enough, whereas women are more likely to break up if it's emotional inaccessibility that's the problem.
Mm.
So, you know, maybe there are, you know, you could argue that there are differences between men and women in here as well, but I think it's really difficult. Also, you know, this whole conversation we're having is very binary, like heteronormative, like, you know, men are like this and women are like that. And I think that's, you know, that, and that's probably where the research is at because it's probably the only way you can do the research really sort of in that sense.
At the moment, anyway.
At the moment. So there is a definite lack of nuance in this whole thing. But, and there is, you know, there's undoubtedly a sex drive. There's sexual desire. In fact, the sort of the American psychiatric manual, like disorders, mental disorders includes, you know, a loss of sexual desire. So it's sort of seen as being, you know, a part of normal humanity. But at the same time, you know, it just, sure, it depends on so many things, on circumstances, on your health. You know, if you're feeling shit, if you're ill, you're not up for sex. And if you're in a certain kind of, you know, life situation, if you're in depression, if you're in, you know, you're struggling to find food, you know, obviously that's not the thing that's on your mind. So it's very complicated. But the best piece of research that I found was a study that showed that if you think you've got more money than other people, you basically think of yourself as quite minted. You tend, and you're in a relationship, you tend to think that the person that you're with probably isn't as good as you could get. So people are more likely to ditch their partners once
made in Chelsea. That's those pricks.
But basically, you know, physical attractiveness of your partner depends on how much money you've got. Well, this is a study of Chinese college students, I should say. So, you know, it's not quite in mice, but, you know, maybe it's not everything and everyone. Mm-hmm. But the funny thing was that was true for the men, wasn't true for the women. So the women who basically have had more money or, you know, were told, you know, if you were in a position of more money, would you ditch your unattractive partner or would you find your partner too unattractive? They said no. It sort of wasn't motivated in the same way. But they were both, men and women, they were more likely to go on the prowl because they're basically more likely to approach a member of the opposite sex if you feel you've got more money. So, I mean, that's quite amazing, an interesting psychology, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, you know, this is incredibly complex.
Well,
because really.
Essentially, it's all to do with your own self-worth.
Effectively, yeah.
Yeah.
And people say that, you know, self-worth is extremely attractive.
Mm.
So, you know, maybe you've got more chance of pulling as well if you've got that kind of self-belief.
Yeah.
But, I mean, and then, you know, there's obviously the factor of hormones and women's sex drive changes depending on the time of the month. So the menstrual cycle plays a role in that. Men's sex drive depends on the amount of testosterone they have. and which also, you know, can fluctuate as well. So you know, but the interesting thing is that actually it's not just the hormones that are around us right now. So the studies show that it's the hormones that were around when we were in the womb make a difference as well, which is kind of like, oh, it's sort of, some things are written into us effectively.
So horny mum, horny son?
I'm not sure it's that simple.
Just try to think of easy ways to remember it. Okay, we're going to take a quick break now, but we'll be back after this to discuss how emotions feed into sexuality, the study of sexual orientation in identical twins, and, of course, we'll be asking this week's expert, Dr. Gerald Brieger, what determines somebody's sexuality. And also, I'm going to Google whether animals outside of mammals enjoy sex.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome back to Eureka, where we're discussing how people choose which other people's genitals they're going to stick their genitals into, or stroke, or whatever. And more importantly, we've just spent quite an enjoyable few minutes just Googling what other animals enjoy sex. And there's a couple of interesting things have come out. The most interesting is this, the male weaver bird. So most male birds don't have penises at all. They have, what's it called? A cloaca? Cloaca. But the male weaver bird has a clitoris-like structure and stimulating it produces orgasm. And then it goes on to say there's probably other similar structures in other birds. So yeah. Some birds are maybe enjoying it. So I'm very happy to accept that I might be wrong and that lots of animals might enjoy sex. Clearly not all. So I'm going to put this to you. I don't think any insect is enjoying it.
No, I think I'd agree with
like
you.
Like the male spider that's getting eaten by the female spider.
They're not enjoying it either.
They're not
no.
enjoying that.
No.
But I don't think the female is particularly enjoying it.
No.
This is good. In fact, males of almost every domesticated and zoo mammal and bird species can be trained to masturbate into receptacles in order to collect semen for artificial insemination with very little provocation. I don't know how you do that training or how you get that job.
I mean, that's next week's expert.
Yeah.
This was, I mean, I had hopes of this being a highbrow sort of episode.
I thought this was going to be quite, yeah.
And yeah.
It's,
Well done.
Well, it's not, is it?
No. Well done.
Thank you. It's not all... No, it is all me. I apologise. Now, one thing that does seem very obvious is that sexual attraction is not just about the physical stuff.
No.
So
no.
It's not just watching porn or seeing someone naked or whatever that arouses people. You know, you can meet someone who just has a great sort of stimulating personality or whatever it is, and you just really get on.
Yeah.
And that creates the attraction. So you assume Beyonce and Jay-Z.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, although I look at that guy and I'm thinking, no.
The money probably... Yeah, like
the money must help, but also...
But then you're Beyonce, so...
So she's not short of a bob or two.
No.
So maybe it's his, you know, creativity.
Yeah. And...
I mean,
if
you're listening, Jay-Z, no offence.
Yeah. Fairly big if. and also the fact that when you look at dating profiles, people are always putting in about the fact that they've got a GSOH and all that kind of stuff. And people like that.
Yeah, and people say that's something that they are actually looking for. And a man who can make you laugh is much more important than a man who is physically, you know, some kind of stud specimen.
Yeah, a funny guy with a raging hard on.
That's all you need.
Yeah.
Ladies.
Or men.
Or men. I mean, you know, so you're quite right. I mean, it's not just about the physicality. You are right, but I was right first because I put this question to Dr. Rieger.
It is true that I've ignored the idea that emotions also feed into our sexuality. And I admit it, I'm probably biased here because I'm a guy myself. And I swear that most guys will define their own sexual orientation by their level of sexual arousal. But there is more to it, you know. Emotions can affect us for sure. It can affect us how much we actually like a person, how much we like a person, I'm sure affects how we are aroused to this person. From all I hear and see, this is something that matters more to women than to men on average. Let's say somebody who's always been straight, for whatever reason, suddenly one time in her life, she has this strong sexual and romantic feeling to another woman. And for situations and moments like this, I can totally see how emotions, sympathy, insight really matter. We do research currently on sexual arousal in women, and we check on how much degree of empathy could actually explain why some women are aroused to other women, even though they're not gay, they're straight. And the only reason why we're doing this is because more than one woman has come to us saying, I totally get it. It's just when I watch another woman in porn, I feel for her and with her. And so it's another level of emotion that seems to affect women more so than men.
Okay, so sexual orientation or sexual fluidity can be dependent on our emotional connection.
Yeah, it's definitely like context dependent, isn't it? But I think, you know, I mean, it's sort of, this can't have changed over time, effectively. This must have always been the case. So I think
but
what we're seeing
restricted.
Is like, yeah, exactly. We're seeing cultural sort of overlays that just mean that we never found out about this kind of thing. People weren't allowed to talk about it, or they chose not to talk about it.
It's just repressed.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's lots of repression in, you know, especially in Western human societies. Mm. And, you know, we basically, I think now, just really starting to escape that kind of almost like, for want of a better word, Victorian kind of sensibility where you don't talk about sex. You certainly don't talk about anything that you might think is, you know, something away from the norm or what's expected of you. But we are starting to see, you know, the sort of generation rising now that's much more sort of open to just being, honest and straightforward and sometimes saying, you know, don't even know what I like, but I know, you know, when it comes around, I can go with whatever I like. There was a survey done in 2019 where 65% of women reported only being attracted to men. And back in 2011, that had been 77%. So, you know, it's unlikely that our biology is changing. We're just more willing to kind of, you know, to talk about these things and be honest and open about them. I mean, men's attraction and sexual behavior hasn't changed that much, interestingly. So it's gone from like, you know, 90% who would say they'd engage in sex only with women is now at 85%. So you had a sort of 5% drop. Mm-hmm. But that's probably because men have just kind of not really sort of shaken off some kind of, you know, stigma and societal sort of pressure not to be anything other than heterosexual.
It's really fascinating, isn't it? The idea that in the past, and now, but particularly in the past, that people just sort of locked this stuff up, totally repressed, and just had to pretend to everyone, including themselves, that those feelings just weren't there.
Yeah, and of course that creates such enormous amounts of damage.
Mm.
So, you know, you raise damaged generations, you know, like that. So
when you first said we were going to be doing sexuality, my first thought, as I said at the start, was we're going to be talking about orientation. And I get how Dr. Rieger and people can study sexual arousal. But how do you study, like, where sexual orientation comes from?
Mm.
And actually, like, should you? Like, something about it makes me feel a little bit uncomfortable. No, for example, knowing that there are, you know, loads of countries where you literally are not allowed to be gay.
Yeah.
And so if you came up with a sort of model that said this is where sexual orientation comes from, it feels inevitable that people are going to start saying, so can we tinker with this?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That feels like a very, very bad path to go down.
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing. So I think, you know, my initial reaction was when you start studying the sort of biology of it, it's almost like you want to know the answer, but you don't want certain people to find out the answer.
Because the last
thing you want is some kind of, you know, scan being developed, for instance.
Yeah, a scan or any kind of like eugenic approach, which, you know, you want to believe wouldn't happen, but also fear might.
Yeah. But, you know, it is an interesting scientific question. It's important. And Dr. Gerolf has actually done some really interesting work on this, on what determines someone's sexual orientation using twin studies.
I studied genetically identical twins where one says he's straight, but the other one says he's gay. And that shows you that for some people, it cannot be in their genes because they are virtually genetically identical. That makes their sexual orientation. And one line of research we did with them was basically figuring out, are they really that different? Because if they just tell me they're gay or straight, it could be that one is out and the other one is in the closet, for example. So we had them in our lab, not too many because they're really rare, but we had these pairs in our lab and we measured their genital arousal to these videos that we show. And there was no question that those who were gay look gay and those who are straight look straight. So they are really, really, really different. And then the next question, of course, is what makes the difference? And there could be so many reasons. One thing that is a speculation of ours and that has not been tested at all is that some identical twins, not all of them, but some identical twins develop with different placentas, which is the organ during development that feeds the baby, that also protects the baby, and that means the communication from the mother to the child. If two twins have two different placentas, it could mean, for example, that one twin gets different levels of hormones from the mother to the child because the placenta works differently than for the other twin. So that could mean that one twin, for example, is more exposed to the maternal testosterone than the other twin, and that could affect their sexuality differently because we have a good hunch that degree of testosterone makes a huge difference.
Oh, there's a lot to get into there.
I mean, first of all, how difficult is that study? You've got to find identical twins, one of whom is straight, one of whom is gay.
So I'm assuming that the study's tiny.
It's 6 male twin pairs and 9 female twin pairs.
Right.
So it's not huge. You know, no. let's put that out there first of all. But the findings actually confirmed the same kind of things that you see in non-twins. In that, you know, you get heterosexual females attracted to both or turned on by both sexes, and you know the female response is the same as it was in non-twin studies. So I you know, that's kind of interesting. I mean, there's a lot to unpick, but essentially what he's saying is it's not a genetic thing.
Listen, Dr. Rieger's the expert.
Yes, he is. Yeah.
However,
no.
As soon as he started effectively concluding that you can't account for the differences via genetics. I was like, are you not just ignoring epigenetics? Totally. Are you not ignoring the fact that identical twins, yes, they will start with the same genetic makeup. However, how those genes are expressed will be influenced by the environment in which they grow. And the environment won't be identical. Even if they're in the same set, it's not going to be identical. No. Like, these people don't come out identical.
No.
They're very nearly identical, but the differences. And then, epigenetics doesn't just happen in the womb. It's also like, you know, we know that the environment influences your genes once you're out as well. So I sort of feel like the important thing is not just what genes you have, it's how they're expressed and that is definitely influenced by nurture, so the environment. So I'm just nervous about saying that it's not genetically determined. I think
clearly it's not genetically determined. And it's environmentally determined. So you know, you've got chemicals in the
womb. But the environment has an effect on your genes.
It has an effect.
The way that they're expressed.
Yeah, that's true.
Or not expressed.
Some of them.
Yeah.
And some of them might be different. But what we're really talking about, I mean, perhaps a better way to study this is in other animals. So there's a guy called Charles Roselli who studies the sexuality of rams at Oregon Health and Science University. And he got into this because he was asked to basically go to farms where they had rams who weren't serving the sheep, like serving the ewes properly.
They were serving each other.
They were serving each other. Or you know, basically, you know, what they found is, you know, these things are, you know, costly and you want them to do a good job.
Yeah.
And some weren't doing a good job. So the farmer was bringing him. And he said, oh, you know, this is interesting. Let's have a look at what's going on. So he got more and more into sort of understanding what's going on. And there are a certain proportion of rams that are gay, and he's gone back, you know, with this and done studies of development, so, you know, pre-birth development, and what he finds this is really interesting. So basically, you have this sort of area of the brain called the preoptic area, and it's involved in regulating sexual behaviors. Mm-hmm. Eventually. But what you find is that if it grows in rams, grows to a certain sort of larger size, they are heterosexual. If it stays at a slightly smaller size, those rams will be homosexual. And actually, the size is pretty much corresponds to the size of that same area in a ewe.
Right.
So what he's saying is, basically, by there's like 130 days, after 130 days of gestation, you can basically see like whether you're going to have a gay ram or not. And there's 150 days before that. So there's 20 days left. So 20 days before birth, you can tell whether that ram is going to be gay or not. And I think that
is horrifying.
It's horrifying because you can imagine people wanting to see it.
Yes.
Can't you?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So
I hate that.
Yeah. I kind of hated it as well. And, you know, and he sort of traces back and he's like, rams are, they're all reared in like all male groups. So, and he said, oh, you know, people have said, oh, it's just like the boarding school effect. You know, that's all that's around. So they're just, you know, and that's just totally not true. You can trace this all the way back. And the interesting thing is that actually, I mean, he's written this great review paper, which is amazing. Maybe I'll link to it on Twitter. But he basically says, you know, you can translate this across to, you know, to humans. You know, it's not that different in evolutionary terms. Mm. And in humans, the genitals differentiate in the first trimester of pregnancy. And the brain differentiation is basically considered to start in the second trimester. And he says, you know, usually the processes are coordinated and the sex sort of matches up, but sometimes they don't. And he says, you know, that you can see when they don't, this basically can result in people who identify with a certain gender that's different from their physical sex. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there are developmental issues, basically, that you know, lead to people feeling that they're a different gender than they're assigned at birth, for instance.
Right, okay.
So you know, that's kind of important. So at the same time as you sort of think, I don't want to see a scan of somebody to find out if they're gay, it's really important that we acknowledge that these things happen in biological developments that mean that people definitely feel that they feel their brain is telling them they are a different gender than they've been assigned at birth. And that's, you know, that is surely an important thing that we understand, you know, and they have different structures in the brain because of this. You know, so you kind of get this across the brain. It's not just about sexual function or anything else. It's like the brain is different, and the brain sort of gives you a sort of certain kind of structure that's different. And, you know, we need this kind of research, don't we, to avoid falling into bigotry and people sort of being in a position to sort of say, oh, you know, it's just a choice, or you know, they're making a choice to be annoying.
Yeah, that is good, undeniably good. It just makes me really twitchy thinking about the negative path that could be taken with that sort of information.
Yeah.
And I don't.
I mean, that's not the scientist's fault.
No.
But you're right.
It's not.
I mean, it's the same as when we have prenatal scans for all kinds of things, and those are controversial things.
Yeah. Yeah. Probably not as controversial as this would be, I have to say.
No. I mean, it's sort of, you know, it's sickening in some ways to think about, you know, how you could use this research in the wrong way.
So it's going back to the thing of whether that is genetic, then, is again quite interesting, isn't it? Because I suppose that you probably, I don't know if your RAM guy has looked at the genetics, I presume he has, to see if there's any, if he can find any correlations. I mean, it's going to be so sort of polygenic, if anything. So probably impossible. But whether he can spot any kind of correlation.
I think it would just be too subtle.
I think,
you know, we've had this in the past, haven't we? Like, you know, people have talked about finding the gay gene, and it's just nonsense. It's just nonsense, because that's not how genetics works at all. And you're right, you know, you get different genes expressed depending on the environment, depending on stress, depending on all kinds of things.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, fundamentally, you know, what these people are saying is hormones in the womb are effectively, you know, pushing things in one way or another. Mm. And even if you've got the identical genetic basis, you know, a slight difference in the hormones will push things in a slightly different direction, and that, you know, then sort of develops into a significant difference.
So I'm just going to go back to this point because I think it's interesting. You can kind of say it's not genetic, but it's impossible to sort of untangle it from genetics and the way that your genes develop and express as a consequence of the environment. So it might as well be genetic. Do you know what I mean?
I don't know that that's true. I don't know that we're going to agree on this, but I think if you talk about it in any kind of genetic terms, it sort of just seems problematic, because then you're implying there's some kind of heritability to it, there's some kind of, you know, propensity towards it, and we just don't know that at all.
Do you know what it is? Do you know? I think you're right. I think it's that I feel so uncomfortable with the idea that if it's not genetic, that people will start looking at ways that they can tinker with it.
Yeah.
I think that's probably it. So it's a quite unscientific stuff from me.
And by the way, Rosselli says this is a quote from his paper. He says, most people experience little or no sense of choice about their sexual orientation. There is no scientifically convincing research to show that therapy aimed at changing sexual orientation is safe or effective. So that whole gay conversion therapy thing, you know, there's just no basis for it whatsoever.
Well, yeah.
And there's certainly no basis to be able to say, you know, if you're gay, there's more chance that you'll have a gay child. I mean, there's just none at all. So that kind of heritability just does not exist.
Yeah.
So I think it's important to sort of, to make that very clear.
Yeah.
And he says, basically, all the data suggests that genes and hormones are important regulators of sexual orientation, and he's basically saying you can't, you know, we can't as yet sort of separate them out. Well, I mean, you know, we do make progress in these kinds of researches, don't we?
Yeah. Okay, let's sum it up. What determines somebody's sexuality? I'm hoping you asked Dr. Rieger.
Yeah, of course I did.
The big question is, what determines somebody's sexuality? For each individual, for each of us, I cannot answer this. But for humans as a group, I can tell you that most of it will be biological. There will be prenatal hormonal influences, likely the level of testosterone or the degree to which we respond to testosterone in our early development. Our genes will have a lot to do with it. And there are other biological influences. We think that the maternal immune system, if she forms antibodies against your own babies can affect our sexual orientation as well. So what determines sexual orientation? It is not social for most of us, even if we don't know fully yet what it is.
I feel like he dropped a couple of bombs in there, really.
Yeah, but actually, no, but I feel quite vindicated. I think he's just more eloquently sort of expressed what I was trying to express. I think that's kind of what I was getting from what he was saying.
Yeah.
So, yes, there's some genetic influence, a lot of environmental stuff in your mother's womb.
Yeah.
And very little social influence.
Yeah. I mean, the social influence is much more likely to be that you can now express how you actually sort of, you know, those leanings that you have.
Yeah, so which is actually nothing to do with whether you are or you aren't.
No, yeah.
It's just, are you comfortable expressing it?
Yeah.
Well, that was started off quite fun. We were just talking about banging and then got quite serious and mildly distressing.
Yeah, when I got to the I was sort of interested and then I got to the end of my research and I suddenly hit this sort of like, shit.
Yeah.
It's like, is this going to be the next, you know, the next thing that people look for?
Mm.
And I hate that idea so much.
I fucking hate it. Yeah. Well, let's hope that doesn't happen.
Oh, yeah. Cross our fingers.
That'll do it. Eureka is a Stack production presented by Dr. Michael Brooks and Rick Edwards. The production team is Temi Adebayo, Katie Baxter, Luke Moore and Charlie Morgan. Sound design by Katie Baxter. Special thanks to today's expert, Dr. Gerolf Rieger. Please subscribe and rate wherever you listen to your podcast. It does make a massive difference. You can also find us on Twitter at EurekaPod. Thanks very much.
Eureka is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And then we're way around the duck.
So if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.